This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ask any pet lover or cowpoke. We know, or think we know, that cats and dogs and horses have personalities. Who could miss them? But what about the octopus, the hyena, the tortoise, the guppy? After most of a century of looking the other way, behavioral science is looking again at animal personality. Bullying fruit flies, oversexed water striders, extroversion and introversion, and every stripe of character trait from deep-sea critters to hippos on the move. You might have thought we were projecting human traits onto animals. The new question, have evolutionary ancestors passed personality on to us? Up next on Point, the new science of animal personality. Joining me now from New York is Charles Siebert, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He opened our eyes to the brave new world of animal personality studies in Sunday's cover story, The Animal Self. Charles Siebert, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So we're goofing a little bit with Mr. Ed here, but you've got scientists who say they are finding personality all over the place in the animal world. What's the evidence?
Well, it comes, as you say, from so many different facets. But I liked the extremes, like you mentioned, the octopus, for example, or even fruit flies. I mean, I'll personally never look at that bowl of fruit on my countertop the same way. It should be stated, though, at the beginning here, there are very few scientists who flat out call themselves animal personality people. Sam Gosling, who we'll be talking to, sort of codified the field, and it's pretty recently. But, you know, a lot of people who are just animal behaviorists, people who I think of, they're sort of like grown-up children whose job it is to sit around and look at various creatures from fruit flies to stickleback fish to octopus, whatever, you know, and are doing that for the purposes of usually conservation or animal welfare or various reasons. They have just not been able to deny what their eyes are seeing, which is that fruit flies, one fruit fly behaves differently from another fruit fly. There are extremely aggressive ones, bully fruit flies, and little meek, kind of more meek fruit flies who are more retiring and shy. And they see this repeatedly. This is, you know, sort of very codified, scientific, rigorous observation. Now, what we make of that is a whole other discussion, but yes, they are seeing that one fruit, among fruit flies settling, their habitat selection. This one woman in Berkeley, in UC Davis is studying that, and they like things like, all right, a fruit fly that's born on a plum and their children will always seek out the next plum. Now that's sort of inculcated, sort of experiential behavior. But upon going to their respective fruits, they actually, some flies are bigger bullies and they'll knock the other fruit flies off and dominate that plum and, and they mark them with little dots and they'll say, Blue over there, he's just knocked everyone off the plum today. And then the problem with Blue is there's no one there to mate with him when that time comes around. So yeah, they're seeing this in every kind of creature across the board, these kind of differentials.
It's something that almost all people are acquainted with from cats and dogs, or at least think they are, though we often tell ourselves, be careful, we may be anthropomorphizing here, you tell me. But you're looking at a whole range of animals here that we don't normally pull in to that way of looking at the animal kingdom. I wish you'd take us to the octopus tanks at the Seattle Aquarium and what you and scientists there saw in the giant Pacific octopi that they have on hand and their different characters.
Yes. In a lot of ways, the modern science of animal personality as such, sort of emanated from experiences at the Seattle Aquarium. One of the directors there, Roland Anderson, had begun to notice that, there was quite a range of individuality in these giant Pacific octopuses, which are incredibly alien looking. That's what makes it so compelling. But they're about the least human looking thing you could imagine. Seven to grow to be about 100 pounds, and the only solid part of them is this little cartilaginous sort of beak. But he was noticing that, you know, some of the octopus were really venturesome. He'd come into work in the morning, and the octopus will have climbed out of this 12-foot-high tank. He just finds this octopus crawling across the floor, making its way to the exits, sometimes finding him in the adjacent tank where the crabs are. They love Dungeness crabs. But not all octopuses, and here's the distinction, not all octopuses were that way, you know. Some were just the very bold and aggressive ones. And he, you know, began to, and some were, he called one Leisure Suit Larry because he was always groping people. And one of these octopus actually tried to, like, basically pull in a BBC videographer into his tank. And when she finally broke away, he got so angry, he just turned, they can turn all kinds of colors. And he turned a bright red and squirted her with water. Another octopus so disliked this night biologist coming by with her flashlight and shining it into the tank, he kept squirting her with his water funnel. So Roland Anderson just noticed this, you know, and he's saying, you know, am I seeing things here? And this is the last man who would venture to be, you know, anthropocentric or anthropomorphic. His father was a sea captain, and he grew up around the Puget Sound. But anyway, he started to do tests. And sure enough, he was using the same sort of test we use on people now, which is, can we observe consistent behaviors across time in different situations? And among the things they did with these smaller red octopuses, you know, they would give them a novel object or they would give them food, like a crab. And they noticed that some would be very aggressive consistently and go grab that crab right away. Some would be a little more shy and retiring, and they'd wait for the crab to come by and grab it. And then there'd be that whole subset that wouldn't get touch the crab until everyone went away. And then in the morning, they'd find the little neat pile of shells, you know, put aside. And suddenly they're saying, well, wait a minute. This is, there's the shy, there's the aggressive, there's the not, and then there's the in-between. And this is the same way we rate human, you know, personality traits. And so this is, and when I was there, you know, I saw some of this myself. I mean, one octopus tried to eat me.
Come on in, Charlie. We're happy to see you.
Yeah, it was like, you know, and they, it's funny because, but, you know, Roland Anderson, they keep two octopi on display and one backup. I love that. There's an understudy octopus. and he took me to meet the understudy, and that's the one who almost ate me. He was kind of aggressive, too. But anyway, it's interesting because Sam Gosling got a hold of the paper, subsequent paper, that Roland Anderson and his fellow investigator, Jennifer Mather, put together. And they called it Personality in Octopuses. And I believe that that's one of the first times that that word has even been used for a long time toward any animal, but certainly toward an invertebrate like an octopus.
A 100-pound invertebrate that can slip, as you report, through a drain pipe no bigger than the size of an apple. The only thing that can't squish down to almost nothing is that cartilaginous beak. But Charles Siebert, take us through the arc of how science has looked at animal characteristics. You remind us that all the way back in Darwin's time, people were looking at animal character. Then that fell out of fashion. Now it's coming back to look at it. Why? What's driven this?
Well, Sam would be good about this. I mean, he and I talked about this at length because I was fascinated with that, the great desertion of the animals from the literature. And a lot of people repeated the notion that it was due to behaviorism and the rise of behaviorism, which basically, you know, B.F. Skinner being the biggest proponent or the most well-known. And you know, and their conception was, let's, you know, it was basically an attempt to avoid anthropomorphism and codify the science of psychology. And it tried to keep, you know, yes, Darwin and a disciple of Darwin's named George Romanes wrote he came up with this whole concept of the animal ladder, in which, you know, he had various levels of mentation and then species going up this scale that, of course, culminated in us. But he had absurd things like, you know, memory first appeared in starfishes, you know. But it was a very, it was an emotive, intuitive, and somewhat naive notion. And they were very fearless about, you know, using them at least analogously. There were chapters in books back in that Sam Gosling showed me back in the 1930s, you know, that had studies of bacteria in human psychology textbooks. And I think the behaviorists, in an attempt to really codify the science of human personality and in human psychology, wanted to avoid any kind of fuzzy, you know, projections. And, you know, Skinner basically maintained the human mind is a black box and that all human experiences are inherently subjective and they're known only to the one who's experiencing them. So if we can't know the human mind, how could we even begin to think that we could project upon what's going on in an animal? And my theory, and I think Sam agrees with this, is that I think one of the irony is that in pursuit of hard science, we eliminated animals even on an analogous level. And the irony is that I think what it's allowed it them back in, animals, I mean, is hard science, but of a new nature, which is that we now know what the behaviors couldn't when behaviorism came to the fore. We know better, at least, the bioevolutionary underpinnings of behavior. We know it on a genetic level, not that it's all genetic determined. But so, in other words, the specificity of biology has allowed us to go venture again and make what I call deep analogies, which is we know that an octopus isn't – we can assume an octopus doesn't see the world the way we see the world, but we can – recognize some of the behavioral traits, one, and then two, we can see shared biology. We do share some biology with, not the same, obviously, but we share genes with all these creatures across the board. And I think the point that Sam makes is, why should behavior be any less subject to natural selection pressures than are our hands and limbs and every other aspect of us? I think we're understanding how physical behavior actually is. The longtime conceit about us, you know, the way we think about consciousness is that it's this special ethereal thing. And no, I think science is showing us on every front now that it, like everything else, is bound to this whole long bioevolutionary history. And we're now beginning to parse that in a way that we couldn't before.
So a horse is a horse, of course. Joining us right now from Austin, Texas, is Sam Gosling. He is professor of psychology and founder of the world's first Animal Personality Institute at the University of Texas. This week, he'll lead a symposium, Animal Social Psychology Revisited, at the annual meeting of the Society of Personality and Social Psychology in Palm Springs, California. Sam Gosling, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Why does personality in animals matter?
It matters for several reasons, I think. I think human researchers can use animals to learn a lot about humans. Of course, those people interested in animals themselves can also learn a lot about animals. It can help us with many animal welfare issues, for example, trying to match, say, shelter dogs to the right home or to try and match the circumstances in which we keep animals to their characters, just as we would in the case of humans.
Why do you call it personality and not instinct or temperament or something less anthropomorphic sounding?
Well, I call it personality because I'm trying to make an almost political stance, if you want. In the human literature, there's a distinction often made between temperament and personality, temperament being the more biologically inherited traits we have, what we come into this world with, and then personality arises out of an interaction with our experience and temperament. And I don't want to rule out the possibility that that also happens in animals too, that they come into the world with a basic set of ingredients, but that those ingredients interact with their experiences to change what they're like a little bit within reason as they grow older. So I'm trying to use it in that parallel sense.
Can you give us some of the most eye-opening illustrations from different species you've worked with of the evidence of, maybe the significance of, personality, different personalities?
Well, I think many of the species that Charles was talking about are some of the best examples. But what is interesting is when you speak to researchers, is whatever they seem to be working with, they seem to notice personalities. It's only those species. We know dogs, so we're very happy with the idea that dogs have personalities, but not so happy with the idea that, say, octopuses or water striders do. But those who work with water striders think it's just as self-evident that they do. My own research has looked at hyenas, and hyenas aren't all the same. Hyenas differ too.
How subtle do the distinctions get? What aspects of personality are you measuring or observing here?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things we've been doing is we've been trying to determine which traits exactly can be identified in these species. So let's take the example of hyenas. Hyenas differ in a whole bunch of traits. So they differ in their assertiveness, for example, and that's not surprising to people who know hyenas because they're very... ruled by dominance hierarchies, but they also differ in the degree to which they're sociable. Some are much more friendly than others. Some would far rather hang out in the corner of an enclosure if they're captive animals. They differ in the degree to which they're nervous or excitable. You have excitable, high-strung hyenas, and you have laid-back ones just chilling out under the tree or wherever it is they like to chill out. Curiosity, they vary a lot in the degree to which they're interested in what's going on around the place. So in the captive hyenas that we were looking at, for example, it was the imaginative, creative ones that were finding new and interesting ways to escape their enclosures. Others weren't so interested or able to do that.
And are you suggesting that there's an evolutionary reason why specific species, members thereof, would show different personalities? Why wouldn't they all go to some kind of perfect mean of behavior and temperament, personality?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't know if we've properly addressed it. And I think that's perhaps one of the reasons why previous researchers haven't looked at it carefully, because you would expect there to be, as you say, some kind of mean. The natural selection should work on the variation that's there and just select a narrow range of that. But there are a couple of mechanisms that are already known to explain why you might have variation. Frequency-dependent selection is this idea that the prevalence of a trait, the value of that trait, changes as it becomes more or less frequent. So as there are more extroverted hyenas around, maybe the value of becoming an introverted hyena goes up, and so you get suddenly more introverts, and so it can maintain a balance that way. And of course, you know, our traits are shaped by all of the environment. So if we live in a world where there's a very varied food sources and we have to be eating different things every day or hunting different things, then it would make sense for the species to have be curious versus a species who lives in a place where there's a plentiful supply of food and it can eat the same thing every day. And the same thing goes for their social environments too, so that our personality may need to be adapted to our social environment, which includes the personalities of those around us.
Charles Siebert, you write about the range of thinking on these different behaviors, why there's such diversity. You quote Andy C. at UC Davis, paying a lot of attention to what he calls stupid behaviors. You might give us an example there from the North American fishing spider of the questions that it raises. The female, he says, he finds them most often in males, but in this case, it's the female of this species that raises an interesting question.
Yeah, that's a very particular example of what he calls a seemingly stupid behavior, which is that there are these this one subset of the female fishing spider that is that emerges or comes into this world with this particularly ravenous appetite and is a really aggressive and successful hunter. And of course, for most of this female fishing spider's life, that, you know, serves it very well, especially in environments where there's food is scarce. So this is a very, very aggressive, successful hunter and eats. But when mating, and beats all the other spiders out. But when
it works great until it's time for love.
And then this spider just is unable to make the distinction between sex and dinner and devours her mate rather than mating with him. And Andy C. says, you know, why would any creature do this? You know, this seems completely counterproductive. Mm. And it gives rise to this whole question are these creatures, you know, locked into these behaviors, and why, if that is such a counterproductive behavior, it isn't weeded out evolutionarily. And, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I mean, it's very compelling because Andy C. goes on to say that, you know, we tend to think that, okay, in animals, they're just locked into these behaviors and that's it. They're little,
but automatons, kind of.
Exactly. And stimulus machines and mm-hmm. whatnot. And by the way, as Sam alluded, there's a lot of research that shows that behavior can be quite plastic even within the lifetime of a given species. Mm-hmm. So it's not as locked in as we think. But also the obverse of that is we tend to think, well, we're in control of our behaviors and it's a protean mutable thing, you right. know. And Andy C. points out that, no, I mean, you know, in fact, we are quite locked into a lot of our different behaviors. And we all know that person who's
plenty
extreme
of our own stupid behaviors.
Exactly. And, you know, we can't shape them as much as we like to believe we can. And he raise an excellent point, which is that think of what we mean by personality. We all have a distinct way, a recognizable way of being. And thus, when people say, hey, that's not like you,
right,
they're saying, you know, we have a tacit way of being. And that if we didn't, if we could, to go back to what we were just talking about, if we could behave optimally, like have that perfect type of, or multiple type, where in any given situation we could do exactly the right thing behaviorally, then we wouldn't have a recognizable personality. And you would have no personality. And as Andy C. said to me, that would be a scary person to be around.
A scary person, but maybe just that range of personalities indicating evolution equipping creatures to deal with wildly varying circumstances. We have so many callers who want to join this conversation. Charles Siebert, Sam Gosling, please stand by. Dawn is calling from Westerly, Rhode Island. Hi, Dawn. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I had this very amazing interaction with an iguana in an organization called Biomes. Biomes is a small group that purchases their own animals, and they take them to, like, schools and other venues.
Okay.
For education. They have a big tank, and one day I go in there. I have long, curly, very light-colored blonde hair.
Okay.
I look in this tank, and I see this huge iguana. He looks at me, and he runs to the back of the tank and hides underneath a rock. And I thought that was strange. I go away. I see my daughter, with long brunette hair, goes in, looks at the tank. The iguana comes out, lays under his heat lamp. He's happy, happy, happy. I walk back. The iguana looks at me and runs away and hides.
So you deduce from this that the iguana doesn't like blondes, prefers brunettes.
Well, it gets better in that. So I take my children, I walk away, and somebody who owned, you know, it was part of the ownership, or it might have been an employee, said, yeah, he doesn't like blondes. And if I remember correctly, this employee said, it might have even been the owner of Biome, said, we don't even have a blonde feed this animal.
So you don't think it was your perfume that day or something about, your mood that morning? It looks to you like it was the hair. Sam Gosling, what do you make of this story?
I really don't know about that.
I mean, you know, this is what you quickly come to when you start talking about personality. People began to see all kinds of or read all kinds of traits in animals. Does it sound reasonable, or does it sound like, you know, here comes the anthropomorphic?
Well, I think it could be both. And I think that it was these sorts of stories that, you know, sort of sound anthropomorphic that made scientists so cautious about studying it for so long. Because when you hear it, it does have sort of the ring of sort of fuzzy sentimentalism about it. But on the other hand, I believe those are real behaviors. I believe they really are going on and deserve to be studied. So, I mean, we do have to be careful because we know we have a propensity to see personality in all kinds of things. I mean, we're wired to see the world like that. It helps us understand the world. We all describe whatever it is, a car or something that doesn't work, as you know, as being annoying or temperamental or so on. So we have to be careful of our own natural disposition to see the world as individuals.
I want to bring a professional perspective in here from Gainesville, Florida. Terry Curtis is joining us, Sam and Charles. She is a veterinarian with the University of Florida's College of Veterinary School. She is a board-certified veterinary behaviorist, one of only 39 of those in the country. Terry Curtis, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So you've been listening. You make house calls all the time. You deal with difficult or troubled animal behaviors, I guess all kinds of behaviors. What do you make of the idea of personalities? That suggests something that is not just environmental, but rather in the character of an animal. Does that sound right to you?
First of all, it's been very fascinating listening to the conversation so far. And I wouldn't say that you could separate personality from environment. And I certainly do believe that the cats and dogs that I see definitely have personalities, and their owners definitely think so as well.
So they think they have them, but if it's just environmental, is that really personality, or is that something else?
It's not just environment. I think they come they come into the world with certain predispositions or certain traits, and those are nurtured or dampened by the environment that they're in. And I think what also happens, just like with the iguana with the blonde, I think there's learning that takes place. And maybe if the iguana had a bad experience with a blonde, then the iguana is certainly going to remember that with the next blonde that comes along. So animals certainly do learn, and they learn what works for them, so they're going to employ those behaviors in the next situation.
Paul is calling from Monterey, California. Hi, Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention I'm on the board of Dreamcatcher Wild Horse Sanctuary, which is in Northern California.
Yeah.
We see a lot of evidence there among wild horses, which we have a number of prior mountain wild horses there, maybe 125, where you can identify very specific and explicit personality traits. But we've also noticed that if you remove horses or other large herd animals or other social animals from their herd or from their friends and isolate them, you can also see pathological behaviors, which some people equate with personalities when really they're illnesses because of that isolation.
You mean they're sort of driven crazy by being away from the herd.
Right, and it can be very pronounced, and a horse can be seen as aggressive or seen as dangerous, which they are, you know, in being isolated, or else they can be, you know, non-cooperative or ill because of that isolation. That's one of the things that we try to promote is a larger range, knowing that each horse needs about 30 acres.
Keep them together and let them have the personality within that social context of the herd. Sam Gosling, how about it? Have you seen animal personalities more distinctive in social settings or in isolation?
Well, it depends on the ecology of the species. If it's a species that's typically isolated, then it may behave strangely in groups. I mean, really the personality of the species has evolved within a certain ecology. And when any of us are stressed, we behave weirdly. I mean, if you took you or me and stressed us out a lot, we'd start behaving in a weird manner. And of course, you see this in animal shelters a lot. In our work at the dog shelter, you see dogs behaving very strangely. And the big question is, when you're trying to assess their personality so we can send them to an appropriate home, are we really assessing what they're like or their stress induce behaviors, and trying to separate those is a very tricky issue.
Mm. Paul, thanks very much for calling. Charles Siebert, let me ask you, in all of this, I'm listening closely and trying to figure out if science is just catching up with what most people already know and assume. I grew up with a lot of livestock around. I saw many different personalities, or thought I did, in those sheep and cattle and horses. Is science just catching up with what humans know by intuition and direct observation here?
Yeah, I think to some extent it is catching up. But, you know, I guess there's a progress here. I mean, there was a reason, as Sam pointed out when I was interviewing him, you know, there was a reason for the pendulum swing away from what might have been called the naive or, mm-hmm. you know, overly anthropomorphic, fuzzy, sentimental projection. And yet we are learning now that, as we are in a lot of different other fields, that behind those projections there was an intuitive brilliance or correctness that science is bearing out, but that clearly it had to codify first the way by which we measure these things before we could then step forward. I mean, for example, the iguana story, that would have, with the blonde, that would have been called isolated anecdote by, you know, scientists until, you know, and what the difference between the important thing about what Sam and other scientists do is they take what might, they might proceed from a curious observation, but then they do whole group studies with recurring observation by independent observers where you can see patterns of distinct patterns and then say to yourself, well, no, I'm not just, you know, I'm not just going overboard here and projecting, but this exists. So what do we make of it? And I think what I loved about in my learning curve here in this is that we now can, from all different angles, make these deep analogies between us and others and obviate the whole question, that old anthropomorphic question, does that iguana see the world the way I do? I mean, that of course it doesn't want to. We'll never know, but that's incidental to what we're now seeing, which is of course patterns of behavior that are conserved over time and evolved given the different situations. Of course, patterns of behavior that exist in even something as simple as a stickleback fish, obtain in us. Not the same exact way of seeing the world, but patterns of behavior. They have to, because as Sam said in his early paper, I mean, why is behavior exempt from selection, natural selection pressures? It isn't. It can't be. That's biologically unsound. So,
Sam, here seems to be where you're kind of turning the conversation. I mean, the idea of personality in animals was seen as anthropomorphic. You seem to me to be suggesting that that's a sort of anthrocentric or human-centric way of seeing the world, that evolution suggests that all species have had personality and we're just part of the pack in that way.
Yes, I think so. You know, we have lots of reasons for not wanting to see personality in some of the animals. I mean, do we really want to think of the animals we eat as having a personality? I mean, because personality imbues some kind of personhood on these individuals. So I think it's really, a matter of considering what we mean by personality and understanding that that doesn't mean exactly like humans, but it may mean they're more like humans than we had thought, at least in certain respects.
Rika's calling from Pointville, North Carolina. Hi, Rika, you're on the air.
Hi. I am calling about yellow and black are we or spiders. Until we moved from Missouri, going out to feed our goat bugs every morning. By the way, an aside.
Yes.
Our goats love blonde hair.
All right. So there's balance in the world.
Yes, there is. Anyway, at the doorway to our buck barn, there was a one of those beautiful orb weaver spiders and her web.
Yeah.
And every morning when I went in to feed the bucks, she would come down about to a foot above my head, maybe less, and stay there for several minutes. Now, this happened morning and evening every day. And the following year, her daughter or son, whoever it was, who hatched in that little bottle of a receptacle they have for their eggs.
Yeah.
And this went on for years, at least five.
Now Rika, you're not pulling our leg. I mean, you're not married to E.B. White. The spider's name wasn't Charlotte. You're not pulling our leg here.
Not at all. When we moved to North Carolina, I tried to entertain the ones outside, actually the one. And we had our house painted, and unfortunately, I think the fumes killed them. And that's... This all leads me to my next question.
Yes.
Can I transplant some of these? I'd love to have them back. We feed birds. We have horses, dogs. We have 15 acres. It's a pretty wonderful existence here.
But do you feel surrounded by personalities, you're saying, and you want to keep those along with you like your friends?
Oh, they're so neat and they're so beautiful. They're webs. Do you know what they look like?
I'm not sure if I know this particular spider there. I grew up with a lot of barn spiders. I didn't talk with them, though.
Well, we also don't kill our barn spiders, and there are lots of barn spiders. They eat lots of flies. I do not consider flies my friends.
Rika, I want to put this to Terry Curtis, if I may. Terry, you look at animal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see the world? I mean, Rika is kind of offering personality to a lot of animals that she's around her, including a spider in its web. Do you see humans as too ready to grant that kind of personality to creatures around them, or as blind to personality that is, in fact, much around them and we ignore?
As Sam said, I think that most people are very happy to live with the idea that dogs have personalities. However, what I find is that a lot of owners seem to have expectations of their animals as being a certain type of dog. And I think the danger there is that, let's say they had a poodle when they were young,
mm-hmm.
and it had personality X. They now get a poodle when they're an adult. It has personality Y. And they're not
and they're not
so
ready
forgiving.
To accept that, right.
Yeah, it's like, well, I had a poodle, and this is nothing like the poodle. And the question that I usually pose to them is, do you have a brother or sister? And they say, yes. And I say, is that person anything like you? And they just start to laugh and go, no, not at all. And so individual differences, and I think by having all this science behind it, lets people know that animals are different. And just because you have a certain breed that you've had before doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to end up with a dog that's got those same personalities now.
Sam Gosling, Charles Siebert was alluding earlier to the implications of this for our understanding of human personality, and I'm not sure that I've
fully understood that yet. What are the implications? If we can study by some kind of objective measures, I'm not sure how you do that, behavior in animals, what does it, or what's its potential for telling us something about human behavior, personality?
Well, animals have been used in many studies of psychology, you know, throughout the history of psychology, but not in personality. And if we can say that animals have personality, and of course I believe you can, then that opens up a huge range of possibilities for studying personality traits. Much easier to look at the genetic and biological basis of personality. Let me give you an example of one very powerful thing that you can do with animals that is at least difficult to do with humans, and that's what's called a cross-fostering study, where you take two infants from two different mothers, and you swap them at birth, and they each mother unknowingly brings up an infant that doesn't belong to it. Using that design, that allows you to distinguish which is the biologically inherited material of the infants from the maternal environment. Now, of course, that's a very interesting question. How is our personality affected? Is it affected by our biological inheritance or a maternal environment? And of course, you couldn't get away, quite rightly, with doing that study in humans, but you could do that in mice or rats in fact, that study has been done in monkeys.
Are you worried that down the road, if you pursue this kind of study, that people in general won't feel all right about separating mother and offspring at birth, even if it's not human? That if we recognize personality in animals, we'll all have to become vegans.
Well, I mean, I'm not worried. That's a decision you can base on this. I mean, people in their own personal view think, well, having personality means that you can't do certain things, then that's their choice.
And does it go all the way down to very simple creatures? I mean, you looked at guppies. It's hard to imagine those translucent little fish a personality, and yet, as I understand from Charles' reports, you found some.
Yeah, I think it does, and you know, it may not be to the same degree. So there are some traits, for example, that we have only found in humans and our closest relatives, chimpanzees, and not as separate traits in other animals. So I don't think you'd see everything in all species, but you'd probably see something in most.
Terry Curtis, in your work as a veterinarian, a veterinary behaviorist work, can you see a deeper understanding of animal personality coming to inform your work, or do you feel like it does already?
I think that the people that I work with have a very good understanding of their animals' personalities, and that kind of lends them to my presence being there in the first place. So I think the cases that I see are the dogs that are very aggressive, the ones that have storm phobia or separation anxiety. They're dogs and cats in the past that would have been euthanized for these behaviors, but subsequently people view them as members of their household now and are willing to find out what the cause is and treat that cause. So I'm dealing with people who, yes, do accept the fact that these are individuals. They're like special needs kids and seek me out to help them.
Charles Siebert, you spent a lot of time looking at this. What's it left you thinking? If we go much further down this road and see personality in animals on all sides of us, does it end up not only illuminating human behavior, but maybe changing it?
Well, I would hope. I mean, in the sense that what change is wrought by making people or inducing people to see their sort of connectivity with the rest of biology? I call it biological Buddhism. that sort of emerged from this. And I think nothing bad can come of that. I mean, of the myriad things that could come out of this, that's one of the things I see. And then on the more practical level, like you said earlier, well, I think it's like we're fading out here, but there have been studies done about personality and immune system and how it affects your response to things like AIDS. So there's a lot of gene expression versus environment. And it's not a reductionist concept. That's the amazing thing. It's a really holistic one. So,
and a great big one, bringing the profile of life up on many sides. Charles Siebert with the New York Times Magazine, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
Terry Curtis at the University of Florida. Terry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sam Gosling, good luck with your work. Thanks for opening our eyes up here.
Thanks a lot.
Sam Gosling at the University of Texas Animal Personality Institute. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.